News stories continue to emerge about the Trump campaign's tactics in the 2016 election, especially its ties to Russia and its strategies to undermine Hillary Clinton. While Jared Kushner, Jeff Sessions, and others have been caught up in the growing scandal, one leading Trump campaign figure has remained pretty much out of the camera's eye, Steve Bannon. Bloomberg News reporter Joshua Green delves into Mr. Bannon's crucial role in getting Donald Trump elected and how he might keep Trump going despite the scandals in his book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased it has brought Joshua Green back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Haven't some referred to him as President Bannon, as Joe Scarborough did just a couple of weeks ago? Does he still have that kind of clout?
No, he doesn't. And I'm not sure he ever did. But Bannon is absolutely the key figure to understanding Trump, how Trump got elected, and what he's trying to do. Not very successfully, but what he's trying to do now that he's in the White House.
What's his current position in the Trump administration?
His position is the same as always. It's chief strategist. But Trump does not abide a co-star. And when he got elected and Bannon's star rose and his profile rose, there was a famous cover of Time magazine that referred to Bannon as the great manipulator. And that was sort of the death blow to Steve Bannon's status within Trump's inner circle until the Russia scandal emerged and began to implicate a lot of the people around Trump. And then Bannon, just by dint of the fact that he's such a loyalist and such a pit bull for Trump and always has been, has kind of reemerged.
He also seemed to be engaged in a rivalry with Jared Kushner, who right now is a bit wounded.
Exactly. I mean, Kushner is in a lot of trouble. It had tried to push out Bannon earlier in the administration. It's odd because—
Did they disagree, or was it just a power struggle?
I think it was both. But it was odd because during the campaign, they were very much aligned. Bannon thought Kushner was a brilliant young guy. They were joined at the hip. They agreed strategically. But then once they got into the administration, some of Bannon's extreme methods didn't work for Trump. Things like the travel ban that caused so much chaos and got tangled up in the courts. I think Kushner decided, this isn't a guy who should have this kind of power. I'm going to try and push him aside and get more competent people in here.
What about Bannon's sense of himself? He was given a painting of himself as Napoleon. Who gave him the painting?
Bannon has a menagerie of characters around him at all times. He did at Breitbart News. He did before that in Hollywood and at Goldman Sachs. The Napoleon painting came from Nigel Farage, the British politician, former UKIP leader, who told me—
The anti-Brexit.
He was basically the champion of the Brexit campaign. And while I was interviewing him about Bannon, he told me, Bannon set up a London bureau of Breitbart. And had it not been for that voice, I don't think we would have had a Brexit. And so the Napoleon painting, this may have been a little misconstrued. I think it was intended as a gag gift, but I saw it. It's actually a pretty impressive likeness.
Breitbart News chose the honey badger as its mascot. What does that reveal about how Bannon sees himself?
Well, if you're familiar with internet culture, the honey badger was a meme that became popularized a couple years ago. It's a video of an actual badger. Hard to explain an internet meme on the radio. Narrated by a very funny voice that says, "I'm a honey badger. I don't give an SHIT about anything." And it's sort of Bannon's creed de coeur. His way of approaching the world is to kind of go hog wild, never pull back, and always do the most extreme thing possible at every moment.
He was portrayed as the Grim Reaper on Saturday Night Live. Hasn't Bannon said darkness is good? So does he welcome that kind of criticism?
I think he does. I mean, Bannon, like Trump, is a man with a not insubstantial ego. And when Trump succeeded and got elected, I think Bannon, who for his whole life has really been on the fringes of the political culture, really felt as though his moment had arrived, and he kind of reveled in this portrayal of him as the Grim Reaper, as Darth Vader, and kind of played it up in a way that was very media friendly and that everybody wanted to write about and talk about. Ultimately, though, I think that cost Bannon his position.
President Trump has suggested that he feels persecuted, a victim of a witch hunt, that no other president has been treated so badly. Steve Bannon was running Breitbart News before he took on his role for Trump. And didn't he thrive on the kinds of attacks that Trump is now criticizing?
Well, Bannon liked to propagate the kind of attacks that Trump is now criticizing, not on Trump himself, but on literally everybody else. I mean, Breitbart went after Republicans as much as it did Democrats.
You report that he's called Paul Ryan something we can't repeat on the air.
A man in need of erectile dysfunction pills. Is that a euphemism that will that will clear the censors on MTV? He was, look, Bannon, the reason that Bannon was such an appalling hire in August 2016 to people in Washington is that both Democrats and Republicans loathed him because Breitbart News spent as much energy attacking Republicans like Paul Ryan, like Mitch McConnell, like John Boehner, as they did Hillary or anybody else.
And on ideological grounds?
On ideological grounds, I think on cultural grounds, too. I think the idea of culture and Bannon's view of culture is really at the heart of the relationship with Trump and Bannon. And I don't want to go on too big a digression here, but the question I got asked most immediately after the election as a political reporter was, how could this have happened? How could somebody as extreme as Donald Trump have gotten elected and nobody really saw it coming? My mom called me the day after the election and asked me that. And just about everybody I've encountered since then did too. Now, I didn't see this coming, even though I'd been covering Bannon and Breitbart for years. But looking back, it seemed to me there was a pretty clear narrative thread that explained how this election had happened. And what I wanted to do in the book was tell that story, but I think culture is integral to the understanding of the political power of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. And a lot of what Bannon did at Breitbart News wasn't focused on a Senate healthcare bill or on this or that Washington. It was focused on the culture, on railing against political correctness and the damage that that's doing to American civic life. And that is an attitude that I think Trump embodied as a candidate.
My guest is Joshua Green, a senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. His book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency, is published by Penguin Press. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You talked about some of the extreme things that Bannon represents. He's been accused of being a friend of white supremacists, the so-called alt-right. His ex-wife accused him of making anti-Semitic remarks. Does he share those attitudes with Donald Trump, or does Donald Trump just simply ignore that side of Steve Bannon?
I think Donald Trump just ignores that side of Steve Bannon outright, but I do think it's important to kind of understanding Bannon as a man and where he comes from. And on the issue of the alt-right in particular, I do think that Bannon himself was personally responsible for injecting a lot of that alt-right venom into our civic discourse, and especially into politics and political journalism. One of the stories I tell in the book is about how in the mid-2000s, Bannon wound up as the CEO of a Hong Kong video game company that didn't actually make games. It pioneered this process called gold farming, where they would hire teams of low-wage Chinese workers to play video games and win prizes and special magical armor that Bannon's company would then sell in the real world to people who wanted to kind of skip ahead, jump ahead levels in the games. It was a real business. It had investment from Goldman Sachs, but it failed after about a year because all of the people that played these games, they're called massive multiplayer online games, games like World of Warcraft, where thousands of people are playing at once. The hardcore players, these rootless white males that spend days and weeks playing these games, revolted against the video game companies and killed the practice of gold farming. They said, "We're not going to play your games unless you kick these guys out." It destroyed Bannon's business, but it gave an appreciation for the power of angry, motivated hordes of online people. And when he took over Breitbart News about 5 years later, he consciously tried to bring them over into the political realm, into Breitbart News, by hiring a controversial conservative provocateur as his tech editor named Milo Yiannopoulos, who has since become a notorious figure in our culture.
Is Bannon helping the president to deal with the Russia investigations?
He is. The reason that Bannon was brought out of the doghouse after Trump cast him out in March and in April was that the White House woke up belatedly, I think, to the danger that the Russia investigation faces and the special counsel faces. So Trump sent Bannon back from his first foreign trip in Saudi Arabia to set up an outside war room, an outside legal team that would hive off the Russia investigation so that the White House daily briefings wouldn't be dominated all day long by the Russia stuff. And Bannon helped bring in Mark Kasowitz, the president's personal lawyer, whom he had cooperated with during the campaign when Trump was the subject of a bunch of women coming out and alleging that he had groped them or sexually assaulted them. Bannon and Trump worked together closely on that, and they're sort of trying to reprise that now on the Russia investigation, though without a lot of success.
Yeah, they don't seem to have been having much of an impact. If anything, every day brings a new revelation. But then what about other things? Does he have any say on policy, like the health care bill, which also appears to have pretty much failed?
Bannon has a say on policy, but it's not clear that Trump listens to him. The other issue that the White House has on health care is frankly, it's not an issue that really interests Bannon. Bannon has had the same kind of hard right nationalist politics since I first met him in 2011. He cares passionately about issues.
Under what circumstances
like,
did you meet him?
I met him. I had just come back from Alaska, and I did a profile of Sarah Palin, governorship in Alaska, because we all thought she was going to run for president in 2012. And I got a phone call out of the blue from a movie publicist saying, "Hey, I represent a filmmaker. He read your article. He really loved it. He's doing a movie on Palin. Will you come to a screening tomorrow?" And I did, and I showed up. I didn't think a whole lot of the Palin movie, which kind of reminded me of propaganda. But the filmmaker was Steve Bannon, and he was an interesting guy and exuding charisma, and he had very, very unusual political beliefs. You tend to encounter more doctrinaire people in Washington, whether it's on the left or on the right. And Bannon was this curious admixture of populism and hard right nationalism and religious extremism. But he struck me as an interesting guy, and I'm a magazine writer, and so I decided I would follow this guy around. And lo and behold, he winds up in charge of the Trump campaign.
Religious extremism in what way? An admirer of very conservative Catholic writers.
Well, it goes a lot deeper than that. Bannon was raised in a very traditionalist Catholic family. His parents are Tridentine Catholics, Latin Mass. But Bannon, who is a deep reader of obscure religious texts, has a guru, an early 20th century French metaphysician named René Guénon, who was an occultist, a Freemason, later became a Sufi Muslim and observed the Sharia. But Guénon was the founder of something called primordial traditionalism, the belief that all the ancient religions have a unifying thread that was revealed to mankind in the earliest ages of the world, and yet since the Enlightenment has been lost to the West. Bannon believes this, and Guénon was very influential in the period between the First and Second World Wars. He had followers, one of whom was Julius Evola, who's Mussolini's fascist racial theorist, who had a falling out with Mussolini and moved on to the Nazis. But these are deep, dark, strange beliefs, all of which have shaped his outlook and in some ways have shaped the Trump presidency.
I just read that Richard Spencer, the white supremacist, is an atheist. So there's a wide range of political beliefs within the alt-right.
There is, although Spencer, too, is an acolyte of Julius Evola. I mean, Evola has since became a kind of an avatar of right-wing Italian terrorists in the 70s and 80s. He's now very popular with the alt-right. Vladimir Putin's chief ideologist, Alexander Dugin, has has translated Evola's work. So there is a very unusual thread, political thread, and religious and philosophical thread running through Steve Bannon into the White House.
Does Bannon have the kind of affection for Putin that some other people on the right seem to have?
I think he does, but for slightly different reasons. I mean, Bannon, so far as we know, hasn't been implicated in the email scandal, but he is a big believer in the world.
He didn't go to the meeting.
He didn't go to the meeting because he wasn't yet a part of the campaign. You know, I've kind of wondered about this. I was talking to a Bannon friend who said, well, you know, we both know Steve is no Eagle Scout, and had he been there, he probably would have gone, but he didn't get hired until August, and the meeting happened in June. So far, he is clear of that. I think the Putin attraction is that Putin is a traditionalist in the same way, or in a similar way, that Bannon is, meaning that he thinks we need to reinstate some earlier set of beliefs, a nationalist cultural identity, all the things that you hear Bannon talking about when he talks to the media.
Now, didn't he surprise people by suggesting that higher taxes on the very wealthy might be a good idea?
This got missed. This is such an interesting story, and it's pure Bannon in a sense. About 2 weeks ago, it leaked out. Actually, Jonathan Swan at Axios, who's a terrific young Trump reporter, broke the news that Bannon in internal White House discussions had actually proposed raising taxes just a bit, but raising taxes on the highest earners because he thought that would help inoculate the Trump White House against charges that it had forsaken its working class base and instead was trying to take away people's health care to give tax cuts to the rich, which is in fact exactly what the White House was doing. Bannon's idea was smacked down, but it's a good glimpse into how Bannon thinks about these things. He isn't a hard right ideologue in the same way that a Paul Ryan is, or some of the Heritage Institution, Cato Institution, kind of think tank policy guys. Bannon is kind of a mixture of hard right, but also economic populist ideas. I know he's very frustrated that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and some people like that haven't been more supportive of Donald Trump and some of the things he said. Obviously, I think that's a batty thought. But if you go back to what Trump was actually saying in the early part of his campaign on economics, we forget, but he was condemning Goldman Sachs and he was talking about conspiracies of international bankers and how he's going to stick up for the little guy and how rich people weren't going to get taxes. Completely flip-flopped once he got into the White House. But he did say these kinds of things in the campaign, which was a big part of his appeal.
Even though he had worked for Goldman Sachs.
Talking about Bannon, about Trump. But yes, yeah. Bannon had worked for Goldman Sachs in the mid-'80s during the M&A boom. I don't think culturally that Bannon was ever really kind of a Goldman Sachs guy. The guy he admired, I found out, and I write about this in the book, was the guy that Goldman Sachs was going up against in the 1980s, which was Michael Milken, the bad guy, junk bond king. Mm-hmm. I think in his heart, that's who Bannon wanted to be. And in a sense, that's kind of what he's become in a political context 20 years later.
Although in another world, Michael Milken wound up going to prison. Well, that's unlikely today.
A lot of these Trump guys could too.
Joshua Green is senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, focusing on political coverage for the magazine and Bloomberg News. He has written for most of our leading publications, and his book is Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency, published by Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Joshua Green, his new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency, is published by Penguin Press, and I guess it's going to be reviewed in the Times tomorrow by Brett Stevens.
Yeah, just saw the review. They called it compulsively readable. Can I put in a plug for my own book? That's probably
of course
day class A, but deeply reported and compulsively readable. So there's my Brett Stevens pitch.
Now, we were talking about his struggles with Jared Kushner. Mm-hmm. Didn't Kushner support the firing of James Comey? What did Bannon think about that?
Bannon, according to everybody I talked to, Bannon thought that was a bad idea. You know, he told Trump, you can't fire the FBI. But Trump, as we know, is an impulsive, vindictive guy. He didn't like the fact that Comey's investigation was dominating and taking away from Trump what Trump felt was his due. And Jared Kushner, who is a subject of that investigation, thought otherwise. Maybe he thought that getting rid of Comey would help his own problems, but he encouraged Trump. Trump did it, and it all backfired immediately.
Wasn't Bannon more important to Trump's win last November than Kushner, Ivanka, or any other leading Republican? Doesn't that carry much weight with Donald Trump?
I don't think Donald Trump thinks in terms of crediting other people. I think he looks at people.
He didn't say that Bannon is beautiful, just beautiful.
No. Maybe he did at some point. I think he looks at people through the lens of, is this person useful to me right now? Bannon was during the campaign, but he wasn't come March and April.
What effect might forcing Bannon out have on Trump's political prospects? He's already filed some paperwork for 2020. He seems to be holding political rallies.
This is a big debate kind of going on in Washington right now. What would happen if Trump fired Bannon? One line of thinking is like, look, Trump is such a clearly defined figure that it wouldn't really faze people. The other way of thinking about this is, you know, Bannon is the heart and soul of Trumpism. He represents the Breitbart crowd, the populists. That is the group right now that is sticking with Trump and propping him up. Those are the 36-38% that Trump's got right now. And so if you fired Bannon, you run the risk of alienating those people. And then who knows how much further Trump could fall.
Has Bannon said anything about the president's penchant for tweeting, especially since it often causes an unnecessary stir?
He hasn't said anything publicly that I'm aware of. We talked about it once a couple of months ago when Trump was in the midst of some tweet explosion that was causing chaos. And I was surprised to have him say that he actually supported it. Bannon is very much a new media guy. Remember, Breitbart was not TV. It was not print. It was only online. Bannon is a big believer that you can work around the traditional media, and the Twitter and Facebook were this wonderful pipe to connect Trump directly to his own supporters, and that by tweeting this outrageous stuff that roiled Washington, he was, Bannon believed, discrediting the mainstream media and his political opponents in a way that was helpful.
We should point out that Breitbart is interested in things other than politics. Recently, they reported approvingly on some segment we had done on our show about something in the arts. So Breitbart is not just about attack journalism.
No, it's not. And they're not doctrinaire thinkers. People don't pay much attention to this part of Breitbart, but they hired John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Wonderful financial writer, very thoughtful guy. They do arts coverage. But I think Breitbart is definitely best known for the hyper-aggressive political attacks, and especially the kind of outrageous, over-the-top pieces condemning PC popular culture.
And wasn't Breitbart Trump's favorite news site, or at least didn't he say that?
It was. BuzzFeed did a fascinating study on the campaign. They analyzed all of Trump's tweets to find out what news outlets Trump cited most. And I think Breitbart was far and away the top Trump citation.
Breitbart broke news stories. They broke the story about Anthony Weiner.
Andrew Breitbart himself broke the story about Anthony Weiner. And that's one of the moments, I think, that really vaulted Breitbart News to prominence. I mean, they used to be known more as being the home of Andrew Breitbart himself, who was a real impresario and rabble-rouser who knew how to get on television. But after he died suddenly in 2012, the site, driven by Bannon more than anybody else, I think, really became known for something different.
If Andrew Breitbart hadn't died, might he have wound up joining the Trump campaign?
You know, I only knew Andrew Breitbart slightly, but I absolutely think he could have. Yeah, I mean, he was a populist. He's against the liberal popular culture. Breitbart himself was really more focused on culture than he was politics. But a big part of Trump's appeal is that this idea that he is railing and pushing back against PC culture and restoring an older, whiter, more conservative generation to primacy in American life, a primacy that they've lost with the rise of Obama and with the rise of a younger, more multicultural generation.
With the growing role of dark money in politics, and analysts and others have worried about politicians being bought, but in what sense was the presidency stormed, as you suggest in your subtitle?
I think it was stormed in the sense that nobody saw this coming. I try to think of a way to characterize this in the book, and the way I tell the story is I describe Breitbart and talk radio and all these conservative outlets that were thought to be fringy and unimportant as a kind of conservative underworld that operated in parallel with Fox News and the National Review and all the more or less respectable conservative outlets that we knew about.
You have Alex Jones on the extreme. And yet,
absolutely.
Hey, Alex Jones has a lot of followers.
Matt Drudge, absolutely, yeah. And I think the story of Donald Trump and the story of the 2016 GOP campaign was that all of us, and I include myself here, did not recognize the power that this conservative underworld had to shape Republican politics, because once Trump came out and started speaking their language with great help from Steve Bannon and Breitbart News, voters responded, and Trump wound up wiping out what was supposed to be the strongest field of Republican presidential candidates in a generation.
When he was at Breitbart, Bannon launched the Government Accountability Institute with Pete Schweizer. Does Bannon view modern U.S. government as unaccountable in some way?
Oh, absolutely. He views it as corrupt, full of crony capitalists. The GAI, the Government Accountability Institute, is a Tallahassee, Florida-based nonprofit that's most famous for having produced the Clinton Cash book that came out, a best-selling book detailing the Clinton Foundation's ties to foreign donors. It came out, it became a surprise bestseller in June of 2015, just as Clinton was launching her presidential candidate, and kind of tarnished her image in a way that really hurt her. But all of this had been planned by Bannon, by Peter Schweizer, by the Mercer family that funded this outfit for years, literally for years before it happened.
Has he been critical of the Mercer family? David Magerman, a former colleague of Robert Mercer, wrote that Mercer now owns a sizable share of the U.S. presidency.
I think that's right. I've never heard Bannon criticize the Mercers at all. They are basically his patrons, or as I describe it, they're really the merchant bankers. I mean, Bannon is the one in charge of that relationship, taking their millions and millions of dollars, setting up these outside outfits, these super PACs, donating directly to Trump, and it is Rebecca Mercer, Robert Mercer's daughter, who talked Trump into hiring Steve Bannon as campaign manager when his campaign looked like it was in a death spiral in August of 2016.
Historian Nancy McLean argues that conservatives like the Koch brothers and Steve Bannon know that their policies are unpopular, and that has guided their strategy for years. Does Bannon think that voters are simply wrong?
No, I don't think Bannon agrees with that. I think that critique applies to the Koch brothers. I think it applies to a lot of conservative donors.
Well, she's talking about the people who followed James Buchanan's ideas.
Well, it could be. I think that Bannon truly believes that the kind of populism he espouses would be wildly popular if only it were given a full airing. He thought Trump would do that, but he has this grandiose idea that if only Trump will talk about this stuff, then not only will Republicans support him, but the Bernie Sanders supporters and the people on the left will somehow gravitate into Trump's column. Bannon still believes that.
Well, last November, the New York Times reported that while he was working in Hollywood, Bannon suggested the vote should be restricted to property owners, as it was when the United States was founded. Does he support current Republican proposals on voter ID?
I'm sure he does.
Or districting? The same Times report quoted a former Hollywood colleague as saying that Bannon occasionally talked about the genetic superiority of some people.
Bannon, as we've covered, Bannon has some very weird ideas rooted, I think, in his philosophy. And it's hard to tell with Bannon in these reports. He's such a caustic guy. I could see him making the landowners, quote, just as a kind of cutting aside. I don't know if he really believes that or not, but he absolutely is behind the voter ID effort that the mainstream Republican Party is pushing to try and institute these voter ID laws that would disenfranchise a lot of current Democratic voters.
He encouraged Jeff Sessions to run for president at one point, and you would think that Ted Cruz might be the person he would feel a greater affinity to. How did he wind up with Trump, joining it pretty late in the election season?
Bannon and Sessions are and were really the two most prominent populists in Washington. There isn't really a lot of populist representation, certainly not right-wing populist representation in the U.S. Congress, but Sessions fits that mold. And Bannon, in 2013, had tried to talk, I tell the story in the book, had tried to talk him into running for president, not because he thought Sessions could win. You know, Jeff Sessions is hardly a charismatic figure, but because he thought by Sessions running, he could elevate the issues of immigration restrictions and curbing free trade to the top of the Republican ledger. So Sessions wound up saying, no, I'm not going to do that. But 3 years later, when Trump was running and winning in the primaries, you know, we forget, but there wasn't a single elected Republican figure, at least not at the national level, that gave Trump any support until very late. I have a scene in the book where Bannon calls up Sessions. He's sitting in his car at an airport and says, I need you to introduce Donald Trump. This is the guy we've been waiting for. This is the guy who can elevate our ideas and get elected. And Sessions tells him, you know, I'm going to lose my status within the Republican Party. I am going to get essentially cast out by my own party if I support Donald Trump and he loses. But in the end, Sessions got out on stage. He put on the red Make America Great hat. And really, he was the first of what became a whole series of Republican elected officials that did wind up getting behind Trump.
And now he's in the cabinet.
And now he's the attorney general.
Weren't Bannon's parents working class? Were they Democrats?
Oh, they were working class. Irish American pro Kennedy Democrats. His dad was a telephone linesman, blue collar people through and through.
And he says that about Jimmy Carter, my political views were formed by seeing how a weak leader like that could get America into the Middle East debacle. Was he disturbed when George Bush got us involved in a Middle East debacle?
I think he was, but Bannon's original conversion from his family's Democratic politics to the path that landed him where he is today was he joined the Navy after college. He served on a destroyer in the Gulf right at the time when the Iranians took Americans hostages, seized the embassy. Bannon's destroyer was part of the group from which the failed rescue effort was launched. And the weakness that Bannon thought that showed on the part of Jimmy Carter so outraged him that it turned him over to Ronald Reagan, and he went home and actually went to work in Reagan's Pentagon.
We have just seconds left, but investigative journalist Carl Bernstein recently said that the U.S. is in the midst of a cold civil war. Could that be what Bannon wants?
I think it is. I think what he wants to do is to kind of have these fights and go further and change the culture by force if necessary. And that's why you see Trump out there fighting and attacking every day. That's all Steve Bannon.
Joshua Green's book is Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. It is published by the Penguin Press, and it's been my great pleasure to have him on our show today.
Thanks so much. It's always great to be with you.